The following program is a presentation of Grace Communion International and Grace Communion Seminary, and is made possible by generous donations from viewers like you.
On this episode of You're Included, Dr. Alistair McGrath discusses his journey into the study of science and theology, his discovery of C.S. Lewis, and various issues facing the church today. Our host is Dr. Gary Detta.
Alistair, it's good to have you with us today.
Well, it's great to be here.
You have a very unusual background in both science and in theology. There's not a lot of people who have that kind of background. But could you tell us maybe a little bit about how those two things came together for you?
Sure, yes. Well, I began in high school studying sciences. And that was my first love, really. And my future was obviously going to be in science, and at that time I thought science entailed atheism. So for me, science, atheism went together. Then I went up to Oxford University to study chemistry, and I went on to a doctorate in molecular biophysics. But then something else happened, which was while I was at Oxford, I discovered Christianity. And so this whole question of how I held together Christian faith and natural sciences really became very, very important. And so I decided if I was going to do this properly, I would have to do some degrees in theology as well. So that's really how I transitioned from the natural sciences to theology, although, of course, I tried to keep the two of them together.
All right. Why do you think you thought science kind of was an objection to Christian faith?
Well, I think there were two things. One was that it just seemed to me that science offered an explanation of everything, a kind of reductive explanation, which meant that it gobbled up the space that God might occupy. And also, I felt that religion was terribly old-fashioned, you know, that who in their right mind would believe in this stuff? And so I took the view that people who believed in God were mad or bad or sad or possibly all three. And I didn't want to be like that. So it's both intellectual and cultural.
I see. Now, I know somewhere along the way, you took an interest in the theology and writings of Thomas F. Torrance. Could you tell me how that came about?
One of the things that really I was trying to find was someone who would help me think through how I might relate science and theology. And what I was looking for, I suppose, was some kind of role model, someone who personally had integrated these. And I found several good people who'd integrated science and the Christian faith, but not necessarily science, Christian theology. And in June of 1976, I think it was, I came across Tom Torrance's book, Theological Science, and devoured it. It was very, very exciting. And as I began to read this, I discovered here was someone who had thought this whole thing through and really gave me an intellectual framework to make sense of the relationship between theology and science. And I think what happened there really was that Torrance actually gave me like a mental map. In other words, a way of thinking about things that really allowed me to see legitimate, interesting ways of holding science and Christian theology together and really mapped out how I might develop my own thinking on this whole matter.
Well, I know many people consider that science and Christian faith are at odds, or any belief in God. There's kind of been, some would talk about a war, you know, between this. But obviously, you saw past that. Was there some kind of key insight that helped you recognize there's not a war? And somehow, the writings of Torrance were helping you kind of sort this out.
Well, I think it's a sort of cultural cliche that there's a warfare between science and faith. And it's terribly out of date. I mean, scholarship has moved on massively, but it still lingers in the media who haven't yet caught up with the literature. But I think Torrance really showed me that if you saw them in the right intellectual context, then there was no question of them being at war. They were, if anything, they complemented each other. So in many ways, Torrance was saying, if you see them in the right way, they give you a mental map which allows you to position them and actually enable them to have a very positive, constructive, and fruitful conversation. And that really is what Torrance helped me to discover.
Yes, well, that's wonderful, because I do know I run into people who are still stuck in the past. Now, I know some of your interests as well. You've written quite a number of books, and some of them have to do with just addressing not so much the science and faith, but just the theology and faith and helping people grow in their faith and all. And, of course, you have a textbook on Introduction to Christian Theology. And what's important there, and why have you written these books?
Well, when I was transitioning from the natural science to theology, studying theology at Oxford, having come to it from natural sciences, I found it very difficult. You know, I was switching from the sciences to the humanities, I was entering into a new discipline, and I found it very, very difficult to actually pick it up. And I thought, I'm sure I can learn from this difficulty. If only there was a textbook that might help with this. Because all the textbooks I read were useless. They assumed far too much on the part of their readers. I decided that one day, you know, if the occasion emerged, I'd try and write a book which would have helped me discover theology. Because I had a very, very steep learning curve, and I thought, I'm sure there are many others who are having this experience as well. So I thought, supposing I write a theological textbook which begins at ground zero, assumes absolutely no previous knowledge of Christian theology, and gradually introduce them, which is what I needed myself. And so I thought maybe my own experience could help others do the same. So I think I see education, you know, helping people to discover theology, really very, very exciting. Because in effect, I'm saying, look, I've discovered this. It's really wonderful. Can I help you discover it as well? And so my own pain, if you like, has been somebody else's gain, because it means it's easier for them after that.
Right. I think another an obstacle that I've found that people run into is the dichotomy between head and heart. You know, I think they said there's a gap between the head and the heart, and I think that's generated some negative idea about theology and what it's good for. But it seems to me there's another gap that isn't really there, but so many people assume it is. How do you address that kind of that? The head-heart gap.
I think that's a real issue. And certainly, there's a real danger that theology is seen as very cerebral, very dry, very academic, almost as if it has no connection with the vibrant life of faith or indeed Christian worship. I think one of the things you have to try and do is said, when theology is done properly, it doesn't simply inform you, it creates a vision of God which makes you want to respond in prayer and in worship. In other words, it brings together the head and the heart, even though it is focusing on trying to make sense of the fundamentals of the Christian faith. So for me, if you like, it's about intellectual engagement without in any way losing that essentially relational activity of loving God, wanting to praise God, and so forth. It's a danger, you're quite right. It is very, very easy to see theology simply as an obsession with words, losing any connection with the life of faith, with evangelism, with worship, and so on. That's a risk, but it doesn't need to be like that. I think the challenge really is to make sure that theology nourishes both head and heart.
And how do you go about that? In your books or all that, what approach would you say is, how did you approach it differently to kind of overcome that problem?
I think the way I approach it is to say that you need to think of God as being so radiant, so majestic, that we cannot possibly hope to do justice to him. So you're very grateful you can make so much sense of God and things of faith, and that's why it leads to theology. But on the other hand, the fact that these are so immense, so overwhelming, that naturally leads you to worship, because you realize these things are so wonderful, I can't put them into words, so the appropriate response is to get down on your knees and pray and worship. I think holding those two perspectives together actually stops them falling apart.
Mm-hmm. Yes, James Torrance, who I studied with, used to emphasize, he said, we need to talk about who God is, God's character, not just whether he exists or kind of abstract concepts, but the nature and character. It sounds like you're saying something similar to that, getting at the majesty and the glory of God, the character of God, not just abstract descriptions of his attributes or things like that that don't really help people see head and heart together?
I think that's right. I think theology does its job best when it makes people want to worship God.
Do you think of Christian teaching today in the church, are there any particular topics or theological themes that you think are undeveloped or misunderstood? I know you did quite a bit of work early on the issue of justification, and that's a very detailed study that I'm sure you found helpful. But perhaps that's a theme you think, or is there some area that you see kind of Christians are missing it? And we might need to review this and bring this back?
Yes, that's a really interesting question. I think that there's a general point to make first, and that is that I do worry that Christians have less inherited knowledge of their faith than might have been the case a generation or two beforehand. So maybe we need to say that perhaps across the board there's a need really for Christians to develop their understanding of their faith, perhaps through catechesis or something like that. But I'm sure there are areas where there are lots of misunderstandings. The doctrine of the Trinity is a very good example. I think many Christians are nervous about that because they say, hey, one is three, that's bad mathematics. You know, where does that take us? And so they almost hold back from engagement because they're frightened that if they open this can of worms, they'll find all sorts of stuff there they don't want. But of course, if they do it properly, they will be excited and so forth. But justification is a very good example. Most Christians, I think, to give a very simple example, misunderstand what justification by faith is. They think it means that if I start believing in God, I am justified. And that's not quite what it means. In fact, it's not what it means at all. So you really, I think, need to go back quite a long way. But for me, I think every Christian is on a journey of discovery. That actually, if you like, the creeds of Christianity give us a framework for discovery. They say, here is the landscape of faith. You probably know that little bit very well, but there's more to discover. Please engage and discover. I think we really need to encourage people to discover the whole realm of faith, because very often they know little bits very well, but the rest remains undiscovered.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I know you've written a little book based on the Apostles' Creed as well. It seems like that's what you've attempted to do in that book a little bit, right? Open
yes.
up the whole
Absolutely.
Of the, of the Christian faith. You know, you mentioned the misunderstanding about the justification. Could you give us a short, brief definition?
Well, for Luther, who I agree with on this occasion, what justification by faith means is not that I choose to believe in God, and as a result, God says, oh, you are justified. It's much more that even the faith I have by which I embrace God is God's gracious gift to me. It's very much about God reaching his hand out towards me, not me reaching my hand out towards him. And it's this wonderful idea of God, in effect, providing all we need. And that's such an important emphasis, because we very often feel that there are certain things that we need to achieve in order to be right with God. And Luther is saying, no, God does it. You know, in effect, we need to trust God and get on in the knowledge that relationship with him is secure.
Mm-hmm. I know some have raised the question so are you saying that we're justified by our belief in the doctrine of itself? And of course that's not where we want to go.
It's not where we want to go at all. I mean, if I could coin a phrase, that's justification by words, you know, rather than justification by faith.
Yes, right. Now, I know you've had some interest in C.S. Lewis. And so tell us about that. How did you encounter Lewis, and what have you taken away from
him? Well, I was born in Belfast, and actually Lewis was born in Belfast as well.
Right.
But interestingly, when I was growing up in Northern Ireland, I always thought Lewis was English. You know, it's one of those things that, you know, I never really made that connection. But I didn't read him. What happened was, when I discovered Christianity, I began to ask all kinds of hard questions. And my friends got fed up. And eventually, one of them said to me, look, why don't you read C.S. Lewis? So I said, oh, well, okay. So I went and bought my first ever book by C.S. Lewis in 1974, I think it was. And kind of way thought, this is good. And bought more books by C.S. Lewis and thought, these are good. And kept on reading them. And actually, I began almost a lifelong relationship with C.S. Lewis, because he is so good. He's so clear. He is very, very good explaining things well. And the other thing I find is that when you read Lewis the first time, you see some things. When you come back to the same work later, there's something else you missed. So in effect, it's a journey of discovery. I wrote a biography of him recently to celebrate the 50th anniversary of his death. And I think one of the things I discovered is that in researching that biography, I actually came to appreciate the man all the more, simply because I began to discover more of him as a man, as a deeply flawed, damaged human being who nevertheless achieved remarkable things. And I think that certainly gave me hope for myself.
Right, yes. I've actually had a similar experience as well. Now, Lewis is known as an apologist. I think he was more than that. But a lot of people concentrate on his apologetics and things like that. Now, I know, of course, you have an interest in apologetics as well. Do you approach that task, that ministry, in a similar way, or do you approach it a little bit differently than Lewis did?
I'm sure there are differences between me and Lewis, but I think the similarity between Lewis and myself is we're both atheists who became Christians and know why we did it. In other words, you know, we've inhabited another place and we understand the patterns of thought in that place. We've moved to a different place and know why we made that transition. But now we're both well-placed to be able to say to people who are still in a sort of place of unbelief, here are some problems you have, and actually here are some things about Christianity you probably haven't grasped. So for me, apologetics comes very naturally. It's about me trying to set out some of the reasons that brought me to faith, but also, I think, engaging with some of the questions our culture is asking. For example, Richard Dawkins and others are saying, well, you know, you can't believe anything you can't prove. I mean, that's just right, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And so I take great pleasure in exposing all his hidden beliefs that are unjustified, trying to make the point that actually we do believe an awful lot of things which cannot be proven, and yet we have good reason for thinking are right. So for me, apologetics really is very important. It's about the cultural defense of the Christian faith. And also, going back to a point we were talking about earlier, you know, I was just suggesting maybe people don't know their faith as well as they should. But actually, all of us probably has to have some kind of apologetic ministry trying to explain what Christianity is and also why it makes so much sense.
Right, yes. As you've interacted with people who are outside the church and outside the Christian faith, do you have some sense... Is there kind of a general sense of what those outside the church and Christian faith don't get, and what perhaps Christians need to be aware of and sensitive to and address first? Are we kind of missing the boat in some ways, and where would we focus conversations with those who aren't in the church?
Well, I think that there are a lot of very important points here. One is, I think, that an awful lot of people just don't see what the point of belief in God is. And I think that's a very important point. They think that believing in God means believing there's some extra item in the universe, like an extra planet orbiting the sun. You know, it may be there, but it makes no difference. So why get so excited about that? I think what you have to try and do is something like discovering meaning or being loved. It's something that is not simply cognitive, but relational. It's something that changes life. And I think trying to bring out the fact that belief in God is about discovering what life is all about. I think that's very, very important. But moving on from that, I think a lot of people outside the church are deeply puzzled as to why people should believe in God at all. And I think that very often we have to say, look, there are some very good reasons for this, and try to set out what some of these are. And that very often people are not being hostile when they say, we can't see why you believe in God. They're actually curious, they're inquisitive. And I think it's important to tell your own personal story, which is, look, here is how I discovered faith, or here is how I grew in my faith, or here is how I was in a household of faith and discovered its inner meaning and so on. It's very important to tell those stories and help people grasp that actually believing in God is not just about one extra item in your mental inventory, but is much more about having discovered what life is all about, and is thus a cause for celebration. It gives you a big picture of life, which helps you figure out how to behave, how to live, and of course how to hope, which is very important.
That seems to put ahead kind of like arguments for the existence of God, or kind of abstract proofs. You're talking about something that talks about relevance and meaning and significance. Because I know some apologetics sounds pretty arid and, you know, a line of argument and things like that. So it sounds like you're talking about a little bit different approach.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that Pascal many years ago said you should try and make people wish that there were a God, and then show them that there is. I think the danger is very often we start off by saying, let me tell you why there is a God, and people aren't interested in the question. You've got to, in effect, make them want to ask the question, because this sounds interesting.
Right, right. Now, you do a lot of speaking and things, and I suppose there's a mix of Christians and non-believers in the audience and all that. What have you learned from that in that context? Are there certain questions that regularly come up? What's that been like?
Well, I think it's a wonderful experience because very often people will want to ask questions. And what I've noticed is that very often some timid person will put up their hand and say something like, well, you know, what difference does Christian faith make, or something like that. And you become aware there are lots of other people who wish they'd asked the question but hadn't. And actually, very often when you're talking to a large audience, people are anonymous. So in effect, you can say some things, and you're not saying to any specific individual, and so it's actually easier for people to hear them. But it's a great privilege to be able to talk about the difference that faith makes to people and trying to explain what some key Christian ideas mean. And very often, the response I get from people is, now we get it. We see what this is all about. And that is so exciting when that happens. Almost if a penny drops or a light gets turned on. I think what gets the most response from people is simply when I talk about my own transition from atheism to faith, why I did it and the difference it makes. Because actually people begin to realize this isn't just about some kind of mental adjustment. It's about something that really changes your life and gives you hope and meaning and so on. So I find that really very exciting. And I'm so glad I'm able to do this kind of thing.
Yes, that's right. Now, I know you've entered into more formal debates with individuals. A couple of what we refer to as the new atheist, Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and such. And I viewed a couple of these on YouTube. What was that like to be with them? That's quite extraordinary events, I thought.
They were quite extraordinary events. And I had the feeling that this was like people talking past each other. It was almost as if there wasn't really all that much engagement. They were almost like set pieces. And what I was really interested in was that very often the debate was invariably, you know, what is the problem in believing in God? And it was very, very difficult to, in effect, get the new atheists to talk about what their proposed alternative was. In other words, if you don't believe in God, then what is your basis for morality? And certainly Christopher Hitchens, you know, on that particular issue, when pressed on that, will say, well, I don't really know. You know, in effect, I just believe certain things and I don't see the need to give a reason for them. But what I think it's very important to do is to have these civil debates, if only to show that answers can be given to the questions these people are asking. I don't think the debates are necessarily very productive, but it's very important they take place. And that in effect, faith is shown to be able to stand up to some of these interrogations and actually make some good points in response.
Right. So it sounds like your approach in these debates was not to win the debate, but to have a conversation and to listen and show responses. But yes, I mean, civil debate, sometimes debates don't go in that direction.
No, they don't. Yeah. I think that what I thought of myself doing really is talking to Richard Dawkins or Chris Hitchens or Daniel Dennett, but actually really talking through them to an audience beyond and trying to say, look, we don't need to get excited about this. You know, there's nothing to be angry about here. It's a very simple but very important question, which is what are the reasons for believing God and the difference it makes? And trying to get people to see that actually there were some really important questions here which were being hijacked in the name of a very aggressive atheist agenda, but good answers could be given to the questions being asked.
In my conversations with people, sometimes it seems the defensive questions and kind of attacks on Christianity and all are actually, there's other often personal issues, backgrounds, bad experiences and things like that that don't necessarily get brought up. But their responses seem so personal and so full of kind of energy and on even vitriol, right? But it seems to me if you don't recognize that, if you just think it's an intellectual problem, that we're missing the boat, especially in a personal situation of having a conversation and dealing with them as full human beings, right? Not just brains or ideas. Did some of that come out in some of these interviews?
Very much so. I think very often, particularly very angry atheists, have a personal history. And it's not an intellectual issue at all. Very often, for example, a parent may have died and they've been very angry with God for allowing that to happen, or they may have had a bad experience at the church, or they may feel that, as Richard Dawkins does, that Christianity tells lies. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that's a very bad thing to do. And so you are, in effect, dealing with people who are, in effect, deeply committed for non-intellectual reasons to atheism. Mm-hmm. And that means that when you start to probe, they become extremely defensive because it's not simply a question of whether there's a God or not. It's about my personal history and my personal integrity being called into question. So very often the anger you find in the new atheism actually reflects a history. And you're quite right, we need to be aware of that. But at the same time, you have to say that we cannot be trapped by our personal histories. And these are big questions, and somehow we need to break free from our personal histories to think about these things.
Yes, yes, that whole dimension doesn't necessarily make the task easier. It makes it more complex and more personal. And so, yeah, I always find prayer is essential for these kind of breakthroughs. Now, another question I'm interested in, now this is the big picture, we've dealt with the personal, but now on the larger things, I mean, largely, I don't know if you think of the West, Western culture, you know, Europe, North America, being post-Christian. And one of my questions has been is, how did we get here? What happened? Now, I know you've studied intellectual history and all that. What do you think about the big picture? Why is it that Western culture is largely leaving behind the Christian faith as a whole, especially the intellectual leadership, the cultural leadership seems especially, I mean, there still is faith around. Certainly churches are still there. But in terms of the direction of the culture, what do you think about that? And how did we get where we are, and are we going to just be on this post-Christian decline? What do you think about that?
It's a larger, really big question, isn't it? I think that there are a number of things going on here. One is, I think, a very significant distrust of institutions, and inevitably that means that this means Christian churches are objects of suspicion. And so one of the things you notice is that in our culture, there's a sort of shift towards wanting to talk about spirituality. Spirituality, if you like, is non-institutional religion. It's a personal thing. And I think that's something we're going to have to think about, that actually if people are suspicious of institutions, it does mean that bishops or church leaders will not be well received because they're seen as institutionally linked. And so what we do need to do almost is rediscover the early Christian detachment from power, from institutional structures, and try and see if we can bring that into a way of thinking. So I think that's one very important element is. But there's something else as well. And this is that at least one study of this whole process of erosion of faith has suggested that one of the difficulties is that parents did not take trouble to pass their faith on to their children. In effect, just saying, well, you decide what you want to do. And I think that there is an issue there about how Christian organizations, how Christian churches, in effect, think about the transmission of faith to the next generation. We seem to have failed on that, and I think that's something we need to come back to. But the third thing I think we need to come back to is this. I think that perhaps we have failed to understand the imaginative, the moral, the aesthetic vision that Christianity contains within itself. And we've not helped people to see why it is so exciting and so important. And I think that has resulted that people find themselves having walked away from Christianity, never really understanding what it is. And so there's a real concern for me there that we need to really try and re-unpack the riches of the Christian faith so people can see it. And I think another point which I would make in just wrapping this little section up is that I think also a lot of Christians tend to be quite defensive about this. And that does create a sort of perception in the culture that kind of way they're on the losing side. I don't think we are on the losing side. I think that we have failed to play our cards properly. I think one of the things we perhaps need to go back to is take our packs out and begin to look at all the cards and say, these are wonderful cards, why aren't we playing them properly? And begin to rethink how we present the Christian faith, how we teach it, how, in effect, we live it out. Those are big questions, I know, but it does seem to me that we really do need to come back to them.
Right. Well, make some suggestions. Tell us, you talked about the problem, but how would you approach, especially this aesthetic and imaginative? Yeah, how would we go, or how would we even start taking this new path that you're suggesting?
I think in Western culture that there are many who are overwhelmed by the beauty of nature or who love good literature or who go to visit art galleries. And these are all people who, in effect, are are looking for something significant or looking for something deeper, but might not necessarily think of making any connection with the Christian faith. I think what we need to try and do is work out how we can reconnect Christianity with groups of people who we seem to have disenfranchised. And for me, that means we're going to need people who are able to talk about Christianity and the arts, who are able to talk about Christianity and literature, who are able to say, look, this will bring an even greater richness to what you're doing. It's about really trying to build those bridges. And no one person can do that. What we need, in effect, is for Christians who are scientists, who are artists, who are musicians, who are whatever, to say, I need intentionally to build bridges between my faith and the professional communities I'm engaging with. Mm. I think that's something very, very important, but it can be done. But we almost need to think of this as a calling. You know, in the past, I might have thought of calling to ordained ministry. Maybe there's a calling to be a bridge person between the faith and particular interest groups.
Right. Well, thank you so much.
Well, it's been wonderful talking to you.
You've been watching You're Included, a production of Grace Communion International.